Okay, Rossi, thank you very much for being part of this podcast. I've got Rossi Stone with us here because Rossi's dyslexic, 26 years old, been through the whole high school journey and isn't a parent yet, but can give some insights into what it's like to be dyslexic, go through that whole journey, come out through it and start flourishing and finding your path. So absolutely, that's what we're here to tell you about. So hi Rossi, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, it's great to be here. And if anyone hears any scratching, it's just me drawing while Darius talks and doing a bit of doodling at the moment.
Well, we find that as dyslexics sometimes. Sometimes we concentrate better when we're drawing or doing something like that.
Whenever I was in university, I would always be doodling because that would actually ironically help me concentrate a bit more by switching off that part of my brain that was trying too hard.
Yeah.
So it would certainly improve the concentration process.
Yeah. So you're going to do one, and we're filming the drawing that Rossi's doing at the moment. And the reason why Rossi's drawing as well is Rossi has a comic book company called Deco Comics, and that's his thing. So we're going to talk more about that later on as well. So you'll be able to see his drawings at the same time, and they might have some relevance to what we're seeing. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So I've got some questions here for you, Rossi.
Of course.
What we're going to do is talk about the big story of your life, try and get a sort of pattern of your life so far.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll go deeper into dyslexia, what dyslexia has meant for you in that journey, like how it's influenced you, your learning moments, etc. And then maybe look at some of the tools that you use.
Absolutely.
So let's kick it off. We've got four main questions I'm going to ask you. What was the beginning? What awoke up your potential? What was the challenge that really you chose to pick up and run with? And what was the reward you got at the end of facing that challenge?
Okay.
So first one, the beginning of your story. Where would you start the beginning of your story? Is it?
Of dyslexia?
Yeah.
I think for me it was, I'd start the beginning probably back when I was in preschool, like nursery.
Oh yeah.
But not because of anything I was doing at school, because the fact that I was more interested with playing with my knife and fork than with the friends I invited over, I would get bored of my friends sometimes and just go to playing imagination games by myself with my toys or with any object I could find. That I had no realization of what that might have been, but just something like that just sort of made me feel like my mind worked in a slightly different way. Why was no one else into this? And why was I seeing, why were people gawking at the fact that I played with my knife and fork when I was eating and actually pretended that they were characters chasing each other? You know, the fork was always running away and the knife was always trying to catch it, like Tom and Jerry. So there were, even back then there was a story element, but I always found it strange why no, everyone found that so weird, why people didn't think that was an equally fun thing to do. And that's when I also, it was my first experience of people not just not relating to that thing I enjoyed, but actually finding not something wrong with it, but something to be a little bit embarrassed or about, or you know, something that was that was weird and singled you out. So that was my first experience of that as well. But I didn't care too much back then because you're a child and you know you don't care about anything really. I've at least I found. So yeah. And when it started to really kick in into something problematic was more when my first year of primary school. Little instances in nursery, but in primary school, when from day one I couldn't understand what was going on, what I was supposed to be doing. I was following instructions wrongly. When we were learning to draw the number one in primary school, I remember the teacher was using an illustration to say, number one is like a sergeant major, you know, straight back, stands up straight with a little hat at the top. Now, everyone else followed those instructions and wrote the number one. I didn't know what she meant, so I thought to myself, the most relevant thing in my mind to do with Sergeant Major was actually a little show I watched called The Shoe People, and I started trying to draw that character thinking that's what she meant by Sergeant Major rather than the one, and then I was confused and surprised why everyone else was drawing something completely different. Huh. So from day one I was doing things incorrectly, so to speak, and interpreting things differently. So yeah, it's kind of manifested itself in different ways there, you know, at different points in my life. But through, I'd say, yeah, the early time was my when I discovered my preferences, and this time was when I discovered the problem in primary one.
What moments did you experience through your childhood and teenage years where you felt like your potential was woken up? Who was it, and when did it happen?
I think it was... There's been various instances in my life where different people have been helpful in a certain circumstance and such, but I think one of the most notable was probably my teacher in primary 6 and primary 7, Mr. McGilvery. And he was someone who treated... He was loved by all the class and all the school. You know, everyone who'd ever been with him loved him. He was a sort of well-seasoned teacher who had a big, long, interesting life experience. And he just treated his pupils, you know, seriously. He took them seriously. He joked around with them. He didn't think they were too soft or that, you know, he was never cruel. But he wouldn't mind, like, making a joke out of your expense in a very fun, innocent way. And he was also, he paid particular attention to people. If someone was struggling, he didn't just see them as a problem or a number in the class. He'd sit down and try and find a solution. He'd see each pupil as a project. And he was someone who, for the first time, he said, because I was so used to school reports by this stage, telling me that Rossi's not doing well, and he's putting stupid answers in his tests and all that stuff. I mean, no wonder I didn't like school, right? But he was the first teacher who said, and these were his words, I really, really, really like working with that boy, Rossi. That's what I heard from my parents for the first time. And that was so uplifting to hear a teacher actually wanted to be in a class with me. I wasn't a problem. I wasn't an obstacle. Mm. And he was actually the first male teacher I ever got. I had some lovely... lady teachers in the primary school I'd been to before that, but all of them seemed to value order in the class more than actual progression of the pupils. And Mr. McGilvery actually asked if he could have me for another year just to help with progressing me through school, and I just felt looked after. I felt like he believed in me. I felt it gave me some confidence that I didn't realize I was lacking at the time, so... Yeah, Mr. McGilvery was probably that wake-up moment that there was something more to me than just a dumb pupil or a problem at school.
Who woke up your potential and when?
I think it was probably Mr. McGilvery, yeah. In his own way. I mean, there was other little feed-up moments, but a lot of these things, like the comics and stuff, that eventually, you know, so to speak, saved me... a lot of that came from self-realizations, but I think the confidence for those self-realizations came from what Mr. McGilvery started all that while back. And then, yes, there were some other teachers that, you know, didn't see me as stupid when I was in secondary school and encouraged me and helped me, and that was always great. But Mr. McGilvery probably woke me up. Mr. McGilvery probably said that, made me feel that you can be happy at school, you can enjoy your time at school, and you can be valued as a pupil. Mm. And it's that made me think that, and he liked my drawings, he liked the way I thought, and that's probably what woke up that there's something different about me, but it's okay, there's nothing wrong about that sort of thing. You know, I can tell you the moment that woke up my potential, and it was probably that comics bit way over in secondary school or high school.
Tell us about that, yeah.
That moment was probably... That came from just years of doing badly at school. And when you get to secondary school, you start to get called stupid for it by the pupils. It becomes, you know, an unwelcoming environment to be dyslexic. And I found that I didn't like... exam revision was a very traumatic experience for me. I found that when I was... reading even harder to read and absorb those lines, it didn't go in, and it was even harder to go in. And trying to remember, I was trying all the things, including like mind maps and stuff. Nothing seemed to be working for me, and I still get fairly poor grades as a result. So
how old were you? at that point?
By that point, I was probably 16.
16.
And then 17 was when I went to my hires, and that's when I got on my higher exams. I just thought, I'm not going to put myself through all that again just to do badly. And that's actually, if there's one other teacher who helped release that potential, it was Mr. Gilchrist, who's my art teacher in secondary school, and he was someone who saw my art and said, this is great, do more of this, this is brilliant. That helped me realize that I can not only be good at my art, but I can embrace it and use it to overcome struggles and stuff. It was probably through the confidence that Mr. Gilchrist helped give me, along with what Mr. McGilvery had given me years before in primary school, that when I was in my higher exams, I just thought, well, I'm not good at this. What I've tried isn't working. I've got one more exam before I can focus on my art, which I feel confident about, my art that I love. So I might as well enjoy it this time. I might as well enjoy this exam revision rather than putting myself through the trauma, because I could bring myself to tears with the getting the exam revision wrong and really struggling to get it in there and working into the night, all to not remember the information still and getting bad results and all that stuff. So I just thought, I'm not going to put myself through that again. If I'm going to fail anyway, I might as well enjoy it. I'm going to turn my exam revision, this page of notes, into a comic and see what happens. Because I'd always loved reading comics and making comics with my art. And I felt a real good connection to comics, and they were easy to understand in my mind, so I thought, what's the worst that can happen? And I turned a page of my Modern Studies was the exam, turned a page of that into a comic strip with characters bantering the information back and forth. And I found that they were fun to make, but even more fun to read. Like, I was absorbing the information this time through a story. Mm-hmm. It was like remembering what happened in an episode of The Simpsons. It just felt natural. And I was understanding it this time through pictures and narrative, and it focused on... You could only put so many words per panel before the words became over-dominating, so it forced me to be concise. And the characters were entertaining, I put effort into them, and all this was great fun. It felt like I was learning for the first time, like the information was actually going in without effort. And it made me think, is this what other people have been feeling all this time?
Mm.
Is this how it's been for the natural readers in the class and the natural mathematicians and all that stuff? And I just felt, I don't care if I'm going to fail again. You know, this way actually makes sense to me. I still thought I was going to fail, but I didn't care. I'd found a way to make my exam revision, genuinely fun. And I'd found that it was feeling like I was remembering it, even though I was too young to realize what that meant.
So if we go on to the third question, which was, what was the challenge you faced?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose you could call this your challenge.
Yes.
Which was to go through your hires, your final year at school, and make it fun.
Absolutely.
And make it something that was you.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you basically set yourself the challenge to start turning your Modern Studies hire into a comic.
Mm-hmm.
Was it just that one exam?
It was probably... Yes, well, actually, yes, the Modern Studies exam was the only one I actually made comic strips out of.
Okay.
But I tried this approach, this new approach of how can I make this more visual? How can I make this into something that I more naturally do? I mean, this was a big step of confidence for me as well, doing things my own way.
Yeah.
So I applied other little things. Like, for example, a big problem for me was remembering quotes for English exams, like Macbeth quotes or quotes for my drama written exam. I found actually that singing the quotes to some of my favourite songs, which I loved listening to, like Dire Straits, I was really into at the time. I'm not of my generation.
My first album I bought was Dire Straits.
Really? Yeah. This is a dyslexic thing again. but singing it through songs like that, and also I think Enya, I was listening to Enya at the time and sort of sung a few songs to her as well, but it was weird, but it worked, and that made things so much easier to remember, and I'm absolutely positive that helped me get a B in English, which is not an A, but it's still a high grade for my
standards.
That's
a big deal. That's a big deal for a dyslexic.
Absolutely.
I got a C.
Did you?
And that was a triumph. I got six hires in one sitting.
Really?
I got four A's, a B, and a C. And 2 years before that, I was in the bottom set of everything, getting D's on everything.
Were you really?
2 years before that, except for maths.
How? I know it's it's supposed to be my interview, but how did that happen for you? How did you...
Well, for me, it was the geography teacher.
Really?
So the geography teacher pulled me up, told me, Darius, up you come, at the end of the class, and he said, I think you're smart. I said, really? He said, yeah, I do. I think you're smart, and I don't understand why in the bottom set. And he said, look, let me explain to you how exams work. I said, okay. And he says, I tell you something, and then you say it back to me the week later or 2 weeks later when it's the test. Mm-hmm. That's it. Do you get that? I'm like, really? Is that all that I'm meant to do? Am I not meant to understand it? And he said, I think that's your problem. Mm. You're trying to understand everything. Everything too much.
Yes.
Just tell me what I told you, and that shows me that you're listening, you're paying attention, and I'll give you a B. And if you connect it with something else that I've told you, I'll give you an A.
Wow.
I said, is it as simple as that? And he said, yes, it is. And he said, and by the way, you need to learn how to study. And I said, well, how do I do that? And he said, you need to go and get this book called Use Your Head by Tony Buzza. Read it, and it'll teach you how to study. Well, I went home, and I told Mum, oh, I've got to get this book called Use Your Head by Tony Buzza, and it sounds amazing. And she said, I've been telling you that for 3 months. I said, no, you haven't, Mum. She said, yes, Darius, I've been telling you that for months, and you've not been listening to me. And it's only when the teacher said it to me that I paid attention. Isn't that funny how sometimes your parents can say the same thing over and over again, and it's just... a moment that a teacher wakes up a certain potential. It's like a match that ignites you just at the right time. Absolutely. Well, when I learned that, I thought, it just felt like a game to me.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, is that all it is? Mm-hmm. Seriously? Someone had just stopped and explained the rules of the game and said, play the game.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, I'll play the game. I start to play the game. And it was kind of fun. After a while, started getting B's, C's, started going up the sets within a year, and then I was doing 6 hires in one sitting, which is very unusual. Normally it's 5 max.
Did that boost your confidence?
It did. I thought, oh, it's quite good. I was totally gaming the system because I read so slowly, I studied so slowly that in the end, you know how you only have to answer 3 questions?
Mm-hmm.
But it's out of like 9 topics.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so you study maybe 6 topics really in depth, so your 3 questions come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would study 3 questions and hope for the results would come out. Well, I studied 4.
It's like problem solving, isn't it?
But what I did was I went through all the past papers, and because I was good at maths, I worked out all the probabilities of certain questions coming up and narrowed down the field that I had to study, and that's how I got my... I could easily have got 3 B's and D's if the wrong questions came up, but it was a total gamble, and I won the gamble, and then I went to get a law degree at Edinburgh University.
You got a law degree? I mean, for me, anything's impressive for a dyslexic kid to go to take on law.
Well, I didn't know I was dyslexic. I just thought, I don't know. I carried on playing that game until 3rd year when I crashed and burned.
Oh, really? Did you just push yourself too hard?
Well, no. That's when the games... That's when all the tricks and the... You know, doing the statistics on the previous past papers and all that, sort of hoping the right question comes up, hit the brick wall. You can't play those games anymore. You've got to actually know your subject.
Right. So then is that when the mind maps really started to come into play?
That's when I learned how to mind map.
I just love it. Do you see how, like... You must get this with a lot of dyslexic people, but you see how the stories sort of resonate with each other, like both our experiences.
Well, that's what one of my hopes is, that parents who are listening to this podcast start to see the patterns, and they start to see their teenager somewhere within our stories.
Absolutely. Don't you think so much of it is confidence? Like, my big issue with the school system is just how one-minded it is about learning things in one particular way and how it puts other people down for not slotting into that order, for not slotting into that way of thinking. And I think it knocks a lot of confidence of what you're capable of or why you're going to this thing. You're basically going into a system to feel stupid and get things wrong a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time it's a teacher who picks you up and says, you're smart, you can do this. that's why I think your mind maps and my comics are exciting, because it's just like doing it for fun or doing it because it's easy, and then they get that I can do this moment themselves.
Well, there was a very well-known dyslexia assessor here in Scotland. She explained to me, these are the three magic words, maybe not three, your way of working, four words, your way of working. You need to find your way of working. And it's actually in the law.
Really?
Way of working. That is the disability law in Scotland. Way of working is part of it. You have to accommodate that person's way of working.
Seriously?
Yeah, and that's why dyslexics get accommodations. Mm-hmm. They say, my way of working is by speaking out loud. Mm-hmm. So they get someone who is a listener and a scribe.
Absolutely.
Because that is the way of working that matches their way of thinking.
Yes.
And so way of working is key. Now, there's a default way of working, which is to write things down in long form, in notes and so on. But there's also, your way of working is in comics, and my way of working is mind mapping.
But
there's other ways of working.
But it's the thing, like I was saying to you earlier, it wasn't just with comics that this manifested itself. Music,
yeah,
doing it through music, and writing post-its, or drawing post-its around the house. One quote I was to remember, I actually did through pictures as well for Macbeth. I had to remember a Macbeth quote that was, full of scorpions is my mind, wife. And so I drew a picture of a man with a bulging head full of scorpions, with them coming out of his ears and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And that's still drawing, but it's not a comic. It's just using visuals in a different way.
Yeah.
And just sometimes just using color, or sometimes treating it like a puzzle, like a word search.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we both know that it's not a one set way. There's so many great ways of learning out there. And the celebration of all these diverse ways of thinking out there is embracing them.
Yeah.
And finding what other ways there could be to learn out there. That's what I truly believe.
So we were talking about your challenge was doing your modern studies with a comic. Tell us a little bit more in depth about that. Did you do the whole thing as a comic? Or how did you do your modern studies?
Well, it was still an experiment in a way when I was doing it, because in the background I was still doing certain bits of it the normal way.
Okay.
But as I did this comic more and more, the less I wanted to do that. So I basically ended up taking segments of what I needed to learn and turning those segments into a comic story each.
Okay.
And making characters and little storylines out of them all and stuff. And each one was no longer, well, actually, no, that's not true. So some of them were 4 pages, some of them were 2 pages, etc. But it was all based on making them as fun as possible. And it wasn't for the whole thing, but it was for a few important segments of it. And I remember clearly it was those segments that were the ones that were easiest to remember.
Mm.
The other ones, I was running it back in my mind. I was thinking, there's still not full confidence that this was the way to do it. Even when I was in the exam, I was confident that I knew what I knew, but there's still not full confidence that I'd done an acceptable thing. And it wasn't until those results came through where I realized I went in knowing that, feeling that that was a better way for me, and the way that everyone else had been telling me to do it was still not working, and my way worked.
Mm.
My way brought in results. So this challenge, this modern studies exam, it was a challenge to me partly because it was overcoming an obstacle of you can't do this and you're not supposed to do it that way, and it was partly a challenge of an old enemy exam revision, you know, being a traumatic experience that used to sort of validate how incapable I was, sort of thing. But
the exam monster.
Yes.
I call it. It's kind of like, sometimes I think the exam monster, you don't slay that monster.
No.
You tame it.
Absolutely.
And it seems like you found a way to tame that with your imagination.
Totally. Well, like with you and your problem solving, for me it just seemed like I was taming it through what I loved. And little did I know that part of me loving what I love is because it's easy to access and easy to understand.
Mm.
And that's what excites me about it so much. To me, it's just like I'm turning it into something I enjoy more. But looking into it, I wouldn't enjoy it so much if it was so difficult to do, if it was so frustrating to do.
Yeah.
And that's why just reading from a block of text was so frustrating because I'd have to break into the text. I'd have to get good at the reading or get into a good reading rhythm in order to get to the juiciness of the story inside. I'm a much better reader now, and practice does make perfect, but I got into reading in the end through reading more comics, more story-based computer games, and then from there into easier books. And I'm still, I don't think I'm a perfect reader, I still think I struggle, but I can read novels for fun now.
Yeah.
And
When do you think that kind of happened for you, that you felt like, I actually enjoy reading now, or reading, but you became confident and pleasurable with reading?
Probably, and I think a lot of people can relate to this, dyslexia or not, and probably during my university years.
Right.
Because once you're out of school, there's so much freedom in university. You're all history, science, maths gradually become interesting again because you're out of the system that you associated them with negativity and being forced to learn.
Mm.
And you start to come at them in your own way. And so you start to read for fun and read for pleasure. Now, I do think you have to be of a certain reading level in order to let your reading grow like that, because I think there's some people who struggle so badly with reading that they just avoid it at all costs.
Yeah. So you went through this challenge, you got your hired. Did you get an A?
A B? For my higher modern studies.
Modern studies?
Oh, I got an A.
Brilliant. And then your other subjects, how did it compare to the others?
English I applied it to, I got a B.
Okay.
I was expected to get a C.
Yeah.
And in history, I applied this to, and I got a B again. History was another shaky subject, getting C's and D's.
Lots of writing.
So, yeah, essentially.
I mean, you chose some pretty tough subjects. Modern studies, history, and English
Modern studies was a big mistake. I thought it was all going to be like news and like news round constantly and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of reading. But I took drama and art as well. You know, mm-hmm. The ironic thing?
No.
Here are my grades. A in modern studies, B in English, B in history, A in drama, because I had a practical exam, C in art.
C in art?
Because I had to do a crafts project that year and it didn't work out too well. But
projects, dyslexics and projects.
Yeah.
Organization of a project.
Exactly. Yeah.
You got a C in art, but then that takes us to the next part of the story, because you overcame, you took on a challenge there. And you came out with a reward, and part of that reward was this ability to tame this monster of mm-hmm. exams or a challenge like that. And you went to art school, didn't you?
I did indeed.
You got a C in art and you went to art school?
Because with art school, you just need a certain amount of grades, it doesn't matter what grades they are, you just need a certain level of grades to pass. All they really care about, at least certainly with the art school I applied for, was portfolio. And my portfolio was good enough to get in, so I was lucky there.
So you got in on the portfolio? Brilliant.
Yeah, that was...
I wanted to go to art school.
Did you really?
I did. I wanted to do psychology or art.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think I was good enough at art.
Mm-hmm.
Although I got an A. But I saw the others in the class and they were just amazing at art, and I just didn't have the confidence. Getting good grades sometimes can be a bit of a curse, mm-hmm. because you end up thinking, I need to do something worthwhile. And I don't know if worthwhile is, but if you've got that many grades, mm-hmm. you either do law, accountancy, or medicine.
Mm-hmm.
In my world, I was in a private school, and my mum had said, you know, you've done all this, you need to make best use of it, you know.
Absolutely.
The best use of it, what was it? I don't want to be a doctor like my dad. I don't want to be an accountant, I could consider it, or an actuary. I thought, well, law gives me flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the reward. You went to art school.
Yes.
And now you're doing comics. You've got a comic book, you're doing deco comics. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, that story that I was telling you about my exam results, that never really left me. That was always in the back of my mind, that I could use this to help people at a younger stage in their life. You know, if I'd have known this technique earlier,
uh-huh.
it could have saved me from so much grief, so much self-esteem issues. I could have looked forward to coming into school and to being educated. I could have seen myself becoming a scientist or a mathematician rather than thinking art was the only thing I could do,
uh-huh.
art and drama. So That was always in the back of my mind. So I did art school, and I was never knew that I wanted to do deco comics for the rest of my life at that stage.
What did you do at art school?
Animation was what I focused on.
Like film animation?
Cartoon animation.
Cartoon animation, okay, got you.
So I was...
What art school did you go to?
Dundee, Duncan of Jordanston.
Okay.
And it was great, you know, it was a great experience, lots of learning in many ways. I felt I learned more about life and about myself than about animation while I was there. But by that I just mean that there was a lot of self-development going on and questioning my assumptions and stuff.
So you finished art school, how old were you then?
When I finished art school, 2014, I would have been about 23.
So 4 years ago, finished art school.
Yes.
And then when did Deco Comics start growing as an idea?
Deco Comics started... I think actually after first year of university, I knew I wanted to continue this, and in terms of forming it into the thing that I would eventually become, I took a year out after university
okay.
for 2015, where I was a part-time art teacher for foundation students, and I was an artist in residence, and I was finishing an animated film.
Can you see that animated film somewhere?
Yeah,
YouTube?
You can look it up, type in Rossi Stone, my name, and Dominic is the name of the film. It's about a cartoon character who's learning how to be an animator in a real life world.
Okay.
There's certain relatable bits, feeling out, it's like uncomfortable in your skin and stuff. A lot of that stuff comes into it. But so I was finishing that film that year, but I was developing this. It'd been stewing in my mind for 4 years, and I started to develop it into what it could actually become in that year, in my spare time.
So in the hero's journey of a story, there's always a beginning,
mm-hmm.
there's always someone waking up potential,
mm-hmm.
and then there's always a reluctant challenge,
mm-hmm.
and then sometimes the hero overcomes that challenge, sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do overcome it, they often come back with a reward
mm-hmm.
back home.
Mm-hmm.
And they give that reward. So it sounds to me like we're at the kind of story of trying to bring a reward back to your origin at school, in a way.
I think Deco Comics and everything that's come through that very much has been that reward, or a simulation of that reward. Like that, just the fact that I found something that combined what I love. I love to entertain, I love to draw, I love to tell stories with something that was very meaningful to me at school. My
mm.
whole journey and identity of myself at school, and where a lot of my confidences and lack of confidences came from. And the fact that I get to combine those two and
mm.
make it into something that I can give to other people to enjoy and benefit from. That is my reward. It sums up me having confidence for myself. I could have never dreamt that I could have started my own business and be pushing it forward and talking on a podcast with yourself, you know, like that to me years ago is something I wouldn't have had the confidence for.
Yeah.
And it sums up that I can find a solution to things and overcome things. I feel like I've grown as a warrior, so to speak. And sort of treasures that is getting to do what I love.
Yes.
But having the willpower and motivation to do so.
So let's finish up this segment with explaining to the parents who are listening
mm-hmm.
what Deco Comics actually does, because I mean we've just assumed people would know, but you know these are educational comics. Can you describe them in a minute?
Of course. Deco Comics are, they turn the school curriculum into fun, entertaining comic stories. They are most relevant to ages 9 to 12, based on the area of curriculum we cover, but they're...
In Scotland.
Well, actually, we've kept it quite broad, so that's relevant for Scotland, England, Ireland. Even if you're in America, a lot of the subjects will be relevant. It's like algebra, figures
okay.
of speech,
right.
stuff like that. So I'd say broadly speaking, 8 to 14, or specifically 9 to 12, but older and younger have enjoyed too. And essentially what they are is they turn it into a comic first before education,
mm-hmm.
thus communicating the information through the entertainment of the comic.
Yeah.
And thus making it a much more enjoyable experience and easier to retain the information that way, because they'll think they'll have a picture and a point of story to remember all by, and they'll naturally want to look at this and read this.
Now, the impression I got was, it's kind of like the Beano days. So every week I'd get the Beano, and it'd come on a certain day, and I couldn't wait till it came, and it would come, and I'd look forward to reading it at the end of school. Is it the same sort of thing, or did the school buy it? Do you get it as a kid at home, or does the school get it, and how does that work?
Well, you can subscribe, and that means you get a new comic every month, because we make them monthly.
Posted to you.
Posted right to your door.
The old school way.
Absolutely. Oh, and lovely paperback comics. We use quality paper. You will smell it before you read it. If you want to catch up on them, we do catch up sets for the comics that you've missed and all that stuff. And it's not chronological. It's not, you don't have to read issue one to follow issue two. It's like the Beano, different stories. None of them link into each other. You can read any comic in any order.
They're all standalone.
Exactly.
Okay. But they've got characters that carry on like the Beano.
Oh, yes,
yeah,
they do.
Yeah, because I've seen some of the characters. Quite interesting.
Did anyone stick out in particular?
Well, I was at a dyslexia conference, and one of the ladies there was saying that she actually did a comic strip, and there were four characters that described different aspects of dyslexia.
Oh, in my comic?
In your comic. Was that...
That, I don't think I've touched on dyslexia in like... Oh, yes! Yes, sorry. We also do commissions where we work with other companies making their... and other organisations and making their messages into comic strips.
Oh, that's what she was telling me about.
But yes, we made a comic that was... that made each learning difficulty, each of the main five learning difficulties, into characters.
Got you. That's who it was. I thought that was in your comics as well. Right. Let's move on to the next phase. We're 41 minutes in.
Should I keep my answer shorter?
Oh, you're doing great. It's fine. We'll edit. Dyslexia. Let's talk about dyslexia itself. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got four questions I want to ask you that will be relevant to parents listening.
Of course.
Number one, where can you trace the influences of dyslexia in your life?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just following patterns. Number two, your learning moments. Number three, mind mapping. Did you ever try it? And number four, what advice would you give your teenage self or yourself as a parent in the future? So let's go through those. Tracing dyslexia, the main influences of dyslexia in your life, because it's a broad area. Where can you see the dyslexic kind of things happening in your life? What are some... traits?
Looking at words and getting to the end of a sentence and realizing I've read that, I've understood the words, but the meaning hasn't gone in. I haven't absorbed the information of that sentence or of that paragraph. Though I'm a lot better now, I'll still get instances, and I got them a lot more growing up, of staring at a page for 40 to 45 minutes and still nothing going in. So it can take me ages just to read two pages of a book, and it's so frustrating by the end of it. I just want to get into that story and can't, so there's a lot of frustration with that. Hearing, not understanding a question that someone gives and misunderstanding it, asking a question and they think, why would you ask a question like that? You know, misinterpreting or misunderstanding questions, or thinking about the wrong end of the stick that someone's trying to tell me about, you know,
okay.
that will still happen. Hearing actually is a problem. Nothing wrong with my actual hearing, but again, interpretation. Sometimes people say words to me, and I've heard the words, but I haven't put them together yet. I'll ask them to repeat themselves, or sometimes a terrible habit I have is, like with my mum, is she'll say something and then I'll pretend like I've heard what she said and try and wing an answer, because I absolutely love my mum to bits, but she's sometimes got a short fuse when it comes to these things. She's got a very busy life, and so I don't want to keep having to ask her to say what all the time, you know.
Okay.
Again, I'm a lot better at that now, but I got a lot growing up, and I still get a bit jumbled when I hear things.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks for sharing that. I'm sure a few parents will probably relate to that with their young ones. the reason why I'm asking about learning moments, there is, you know, sometimes there's maybe certain courses you've been on or certain books you've read or people that have been influences, teachers or whatever, you know, that you've really learned a lot. They were a moment of intense learning or opening you up. I know you talked about those people waking up your potential, those teachers, but I'm thinking other moments where you really learned something solidly.
So, could you repeat that question?
Okay, so I'm thinking learning moments. Let's talk about learning moments where you might have done a course.
So moments where I sort of realised I've learned that's gone in.
Or a time where how am I going to describe this better? There are times in our life where we read a book, or we watch a film, or hear a story, or do a course, or learn from someone, and that's a really profound moment where you really learn something significant in your life. What would they be? Where would you?
I see. Yes, I would say off the top of my head.
One of the things I'd be interested in. Did you have a dyslexia assessment done?
I did. That would be
a moment. That a learning moment for you?
Yeah, that was a moment where I realized when I heard those words, similar to the teacher experiences, when I had those words told to me that your intelligence is above average, that was a moment. That was a moment again where I realized it's not stupidity, it's not being dumb.
Yeah.
And that was a moment where I could realize capability. It didn't make the work any easier, but it still gave me that bit of hope and confidence in myself.
Mm. How old were you?
I'd be about 11 or 12.
Okay, lucky you.
Yeah, exactly.
I was 35.
Really? Some people go through their whole lives not realizing.
I was 35.
But the fact that you know now and you've absolutely made the most of it, and you made the most of it, absolute credit to you before you even knew.
Yeah. I had a great mum as well who really encouraged me. So, other learning moments?
Other learning moments would be of course, the comics one. Discovering I could do the comics would be a big learning moment. Other ones could be
any significant ones at uni. Was uni any courses in university or particular?
There was a moment in university where I think this is just part of growing up, largely. But when I realised, there was a moment where I realised cartoons were really my thing. I still was flirting with the idea of becoming a painter in my first year of university. And I was struggling, and just everyone's work was better than me, and I was trying to get better than them, and didn't understand why my drawings were never as good. But then I did an animation, just for fun, with a friend for a Christmas project, and everyone flocked to it. Everyone was impressed. It was the reaction I'd been looking for from my paintings, and that just made me click that I'm an animator, or I'm a cartoon man, or this makes sense to a lot of the things I like. You know, whenever I played with toys or knives and forks growing up, I was always thinking of how do they move, how do they react, what would their face look like, and stuff like that. So learning that was very important to my development, learning, discovering and realizing that part of myself really was lived and breathed cartoons. Another moment where, yeah, there was a sort of moment in growing up where, in probably about second year, where my confidence exploded, probably a bit too much so, but there was a sort of real two-way learning moment there. There's a lot of learning because my confidence exploded. I realized I could do things. I felt like I could do anything. I felt like I could be someone who could change the world and all that stuff. But then I also realized I learned to bring that back. I learned that when you let that go too far, you know, it's not that everyone thinks you're great. You just turn your mind off to what people might actually be thinking about you. And not all of that you should ignore. Sometimes listening to other people is a very good thing. And there was a moment where I learned how to be confident and how to not be too arrogant, if that makes sense. Learning how to balance my confidence was a big thing in uni. So that was very interesting because, yes, all school was gaining confidence, but I actually learned to balance and measure it in about my second, third year of uni.
So it's kind of like learning a little bit of humility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think sometimes as dyslexics, we can feel like we need to be so self-reliant, so
able to do everything.
Absolutely.
That, you know, when you're going through school, because it's harder and you don't realize it than everyone else, you have to work so much harder, mm-hmm. you have to do so many workarounds and adapt and learn stuff, mm-hmm. whereas other people are kind of like, well, there's a system set up to make it work for me, I just float along, you know, and go with yeah. it, you know. Absolutely. And so you carry that on, I think, into later life. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the downsides is you can become fiercely over independent.
Absolutely.
Have you found that?
Before the podcast switched on, Darius has been dropping gems all day. It's just these wisdoms really resonate with me. It's yes it does. And that is actually, I think, a big reason why I failed my fourth year film, you know, that Dominic thing. It got finished later, uh-huh. but I started it in fourth year and it didn't get finished, and I failed the project. And part of that was because I had a lot of people helping me, but they were helping me with just like the sort of surface stuff, all the main stuff, and everything important to do with the comic, with the animation, I was relying on myself to do, and thinking, no, I should be able to do this, I should be able to do anything. And the project absolutely crashed and burned. But I was, throughout those later years, I was thinking, like, how do I have to be able to do everything. I can't not be able to do something.
Yeah.
And the Dominic scenario really helped me learn that it is so good to work with a team. You need to be able to delegate, you need to be able to share your load. It's good to be independent, but you can't burn the candle out at both ends, or you'll destroy yourself. So that whole, I was even sort of thinking, like, if I had my own studio one day, how could I run it in a way in which I could do everything myself?
Yeah.
It got that bad.
Yeah.
But I feel I'm in a much healthier balance now, and it was through getting my fingers burned and by trying.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm only beginning to learn that now, really. I think when I learned I was dyslexic 10 years ago, I started to pay more attention to other dyslexics. Mm-hmm. And a common theme with some of the famous dyslexics like Branson and so on, mm-hmm. is that they constantly talk about delegating. Mm-hmm. They're great delegators. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, I'm dyslexic. I'm not a great delegator. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you get so, you're so dyslexic, you're compelled to delegate. And I have a theory, and the theory is that if you're so dyslexic like Jackie Stewart, who can't read, mm-hmm. well, a very minor amount of reading, mm-hmm. he says, he has to delegate to someone else to read his contracts and so on. He Absolutely. Has to get someone to do something else and so on, until he's the one socially joining and networking and maintaining the big picture and the vision and so on. Absolutely. So in a way, I sometimes think if you're extremely dyslexic, it can be more of an advantage because you're compelled to delegate. Whereas if you're mild to moderately dyslexic, I'd say I'm moderately dyslexic, mm-hmm. Then you're kind of, you're not so good at it, but you could just about do a bit of everything. Do you know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It can be worse for you because you just say, oh, I'll just try harder.
Yeah.
Instead of, I can't do this.
Exactly. It was so great when you're in the sort of situation where I can't, you feel forced and compelled to get the people to fill out those areas for you.
Yes.
Where, yes, as you say, if you're more like wider spread and diluted with your dyslexia, you don't have that urgency, you don't have that wall hitting moment where you realize yeah. you've kind of got to learn that in your own way, don't you?
Yeah.
You've got to experience it and
learning moments. Okay, so that was those were some moments, and one of them is a humbling moment as well. And I think that with students often, if you're a parent listening, I think one of the biggest things for exams and teenagers is to come to a moment where you're willing to be humble, mm-hmm. humble enough to learn.
Yes.
This assumption that, oh, I should be able to do everything, I should be able to study, I should be able to do this, mm-hmm. somehow seems to be a trait of just a byproduct of dyslexia, because mm-hmm. we're constantly being told by teachers, you should be able to do this, mm-hmm. you know? You just told me that story, you should be able to just write it down on a couple of pages. Mm-hmm. Why does it all fall apart after the second paragraph? Mm-hmm. You're like, well, you start thinking, well, I should be able to do everything, but I can't, you know? Mm-hmm. And it has an effect.
Absolutely. It's as you were saying earlier, like, you've got to, you get into a stage where you're sort of like having to find solutions to your own problems all the time. And you don't want to feel, I think you get to a stage where you become quite proud of that, yes. But also it makes you quite defensive in your own yeah. way as well. Like you need to protect yourself. You can't let that, I think you, personally, I think you might fear a weakness. You might have a weakness there. You're afraid of being insecure again. You're afraid of being put in a state of where you don't have control over what you're capable of and where the world can criticize you again, sort of thing.
Yes.
I think there's a sort of determination to not be vulnerable like that again.
Yes. So there's vulnerable and there's weak, mm-hmm. you know, and if you are vulnerable about yourself, then it might expose a weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if a weakness is exposed, then that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then you think about the experiences you had growing up.
Yeah.
And you think about failure, like maybe certainly for me growing up, failure was a very ugly term.
Yeah.
And that I associated with. You think about, you link it to all the things you've got wrong in your life. And you tell a negative story about it in your head.
So. And so you're I think what you can get yourself into is constantly trying to kind of crisis manage, mm-hmm. you know, constantly trying to make sure that the right impression is being given, that, you know, that you're succeeding in some sort of way and failure is a problem. But I think humility comes, I remember someone saying humility is being honest with who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you're good at something, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean, I'm rubbish at art or I'm rubbish at doing cartoons. No, it's not. I'm pretty decent at doing cartoons,
mm-hmm.
but I'm really poor at, not so good at painting, you know?
Absolutely.
That's kind of humility, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. you know what level you're at this and you know what your level at that, and that's it.
It's just attaching yourself to your reality, to your awareness of what you're capable of and what maybe you're not capable of that. And that doesn't mean you can't get better at that.
Yes.
It's just accepting where you are with it.
Yeah.
If I could recommend anything to parents out there, I would say learning and connecting with self-awareness does really help. Because for me, it really did. Learning to be self-aware, how to catch your emotions from going haywire, following the stories that your mind tells yourself, and getting out of that mindset of believing your mind when it says you can't do this or you have to do that, and letting it just tell it as it is, tell it as the facts are, I am good at this, or I'm not good at this yet, or I'm not as good as I could be, but that doesn't mean I can't.
Mm-hmm.
That self-awareness, however you come about it, I found really valuable.
All right, mind mapping.
Yes.
Tell us, what was your mind mapping experience like?
I wish I had you in my life at the time, Darius, because mind mapping never worked out for me. It was preferable to bullet points, and it was more fun, certainly, but mine became a mind mess.
A mind mess. <Exactly. laughs> I love it.
You know, like it was, I'd put too many branches, or the branches would have too many words, I wasn't confident with that the words I was using to link the information were useful enough. And I don't think I'd ever been taught properly. I'd been given the Tony Bazan overview, but I don't think I'd ever been taught how to make them as effective as possible.
So how did you learn about it? At school?
Yeah, school had videos about Tony Bazan's work. So yeah, they introduced you to them, and we had PSE classes where they encouraged it. But it never got to the point where it was actually helping me. It just became like another way to get things wrong again.
Okay.
And my favourite part was the colour and the imagery part of it.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so mind maps weren't my cup of tea.
How old were you when you did that?
Oh, I must have been about, I think on and off, it was between the age of 14 and 16, 17.
Okay. How many videos did you watch?
Oh, I don't know. I think in terms of ones I could remember that were to do with the mind map thing, it must have been about three.
Okay. Because mind maps is Tony Buzan's trademark,
mm-hmm.
the word mind maps for his courses that mm-hmm. he does.
I don't blame Tony.
No. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been trying to explain mind mapping to people for 30 years,
mm-hmm.
25 years since I learnt it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's kind of like telling someone how a bike works.
Yeah.
and expecting them to be able to cycle.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll explain it to my friends and they go, yeah, these are the five principles, or Tony Buzan has 10, I talk about five. And they're like, oh yeah, yeah. But they get on the bike and they pedal and they fall over and they think, oh, cycling's not for me. It didn't work for me. Because if they tried it once or twice or whatever, you know?
And they've got a failure experience with it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so they just write it off. And it really saddens me that people have this sort of abortive experience. Mm-hmm. Abortive? Is that the right word?
It makes sense to me. Where they've got the experience where they feel they need to abort it because they tried it, they gave it its full chance, it didn't work out, therefore their saying becomes, mind maps don't work for me.
Yeah, yeah.
I say that for personal experience. I've been saying mind maps don't work for me when I should really be saying I never quite figured out how to do it right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I reckon... So what do you think about mind mapping now that you've seen some of my videos?
Exactly. I highly recommend Darius and Mind Map Studio because you turn it into sense. You have a great way of telling how they work through a story, multiple stories actually, multiple visual metaphors. But the way that you link it to the fact that it's just, I get it in concept that a mind map is about sewing all the information together in different ways, but the way you treat it like, because my mind works in stories, you tell it like a story and you make each branch of the mind map like a story. This is the subject and this is what the story is about. So like thinking of it that way was something I never did at school. For me it was just, this is the main fact, what are the mini facts that attach to it that I've got to remember?
Okay.
And there's nothing really interesting about that. It may as well still be a bullet point list at the end of the day, you know, but something that I guess I'm not describing it right because again I'm still not a mind map expert, but that's the feeling I get through yours, is that each line is carefully planned or carefully realized. Each line has a real defined purpose and it's clear why it's linked to that main word.
Yes. So your experience was very much at the spider map stage, mm-hmm. where it's like a brainstorm and it's
yes.
all over the place. And,
yes.
and it's not gone through the next iteration where things are rearranged and organized. And
exactly.
Yeah.
It never got successfully refined
yeah.
in my
so
mind map.
You got stuck in the brainstorm stage.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so many people do. Mm-hmm. They learn how to mind map their ideas. Mm-hmm. But just like our brains, they're a complete mess
mm-hmm.
until you intentionally decide, right, that's going to go there, this is going to go there.
Exactly.
And you basically ended up using comics,
mm-hmm.
the discipline of comics, to bring in the discipline of let's concentrate on key words and key meanings.
Absolutely.
And stitch them together in a timeline.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. Comics got me to that same result.
So you're getting to the same result through comics
yeah.
that I did through mapping.
Well, but this is it, yeah. But I can't recommend your mind maps enough, because yours, sometimes it's not so easy just to come up with a comic story and start writing things out in a comic format.
Yes.
And sometimes you can even do that in a boring way,
yeah.
where it's still not that motivating to you. But something like a mind map, where it's basically writing the information out in the most effective way possible.
Yeah.
You know, I do still wish I had that I could just get that out. Because I don't go to meetings and make comics out of all my notes.
No.
That takes a bit of time.
Oh,
it's an art.
Investment, that,
you know, but this is a tool. This mind maps is a quick, efficient
yeah.
tool that if you know how to use it right, it can, I
yeah.
don't know, it can just roll off the hands.
So let's move on to the next thing, advice. What if you could go back in time and give some advice to your teenage self?
Mm-hmm.
Say, let's say you could speak to Rossi when you were 12 or 13.
I would say to him, you're not stupid. And the things that you like doing, focus on them. Focus on what you like doing and what makes you you, and what you wish you could do all the time on a weekend. Focus on that stuff and doing the things that you have a negative experience towards or don't like through that. You know, I feel I grew up in my younger years being a typical insecure teenager, thinking, you know, like I don't feel very attractive, I don't feel very good looking, the girls aren't going to like me and all that stuff. And I feel and realize I felt back then at my most attractive when I'm doing what I love, when I'm in you know, when I'm engrossed in what I love. So I think if I would tell myself to focus on that stuff and doing everything through what you love, because that's going to not just benefit your schoolwork and those sort of challenges, but it will treat, you won't need to feel so insecure to try and suck up to bullies, or you won't need to get all wound up about your brother teasing you and all that stuff. You can find ways of, I don't know, I just think being connected to what you love gives you confidence, gives you self-acceptance and
so
solutions.
Being, let's say you're more specific to yourself when you're 12 or 13,
mm-hmm.
you know what you were like at 12 and 13. Would you give any specific advice to yourself when you're 12 and 13?
Yes.
Which would be like, I don't know, draw that particular comic, do this particular thing that you're thinking or
yeah, about. Draw that comic, do that idea, think about that story that you've got in your mind and play that computer game, you know, and try doing that with your homework, see what you can do.
Uh-huh.
And also, I would, you know, if I did have a son or a daughter, I would say, don't beat yourself up over this. Or rather than telling them to. As
you're listener. Jumping to the next question. Okay, so let's go to the next question. Ask the question. Yeah. What advice would you give yourself as a parent? So you're going into the future, you're not a parent yet, are you?
No, I'm not.
No? So you're going into the future and you've got a teenager. What advice are you going to give yourself?
Well, I would...
On the record, I'll replay this to you.
This is going to come back and bite me.
10 years' time. 5 years' time.
I would be patient with that child and try to understand them. Try to do things. Rather than trying to fit them into a particular mold, because that's how it's done, try and understand why they're struggling with that mold. And finding out a way that maybe, rather than trying to fit the child in the mold of what you're trying to fit them into, basically, rather than trying to make the child what you think they should be, maybe take it from the child's perspective first. Maybe like, I guess I'm not explaining this well, rather than looking at it with reality is this way, how can I make the child fit into this? Why not take it from an angle of my child is this way, how can I make reality work for this child?
Mm.
And putting the child first, because that's how the child will thrive, whereas I tried as a child growing up trying to do it the normal way, and it just led to more frustration, a lot of unhappiness, and my salvation was doing it through what I loved and what I found easy.
Mm.
So that's the advice I would give.
Tools for dyslexia.
Oh, what kind of
tools do you use for dyslexia? Let's talk about gadgets.
Darius gave a very funny reaction when he looked at the time. What tools do I use for dyslexia and gadgets and stuff? I used to use a little recording device for lectures, which worked in theory, but I just ended up not listening to them because they were so boring. It was just listening to the lecture again. So tools I use, I suppose doodling while I listen. That's
okay.
A tool on the way.
Right.
But there were sort of tools that I never ended up using because they came out past my time, but things that read back audio to you slower and easier, and those are easy, those were better.
Read back audio to you? You mean read back text to you?
Yes, exactly. Sorry, what I mean. Yeah, things that read back text to you. I approve of that. I'm totally behind Barrington Stokes' approach of making spacing out the words even more and making that easier to read. You know, I think that's useful. And do I use any other tools? I suppose using music to help me remember things and keep me on track and things. Sometimes if I've got a particular task I need to concentrate on, music not only helps me concentrate on it, depending on what kind of music, but it also keeps me, it manages my time. I've got to get this amount done by the end of this song.
Oh,
this
really?
Amount. Yeah.
Right.
So again, it's using
what
that
kind of music
that
do you play then for what things?
If it's something that I need energy for, I'll listen to some big stomping rock tune.
Like
or,
what?
Well, it might be Rush, like Spirit of the Radio. Or it might be Kiss, Crazy Night. But if it's something more that requires more patience and thinking, I'll listen to maybe something like classical music.
And so you use the time frame of a certain playlist or a certain song to complete certain things.
Yeah.
So it's like the Pomero technique, where, have you heard of the Pomero technique?
Yeah.
So the Pomero technique is when you give yourself 25 minutes to complete a set task and have a 5 minute break.
Mm-hmm.
So you chunk things up into Pomeros.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the end of this 25 minutes, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And so you're kind of putting on a playlist for a set period of time and listening. And by the end of that, you know you need to be done.
Absolutely.
And because you know the music, you kind of know roughly where you are in the timeline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I was doing animation, I'd try and time myself to frames, like getting animation frames finished by. And yeah, when I got to know the music enough, I would actually know exactly where I was in the music, sort of thing. But generally, no, it's more of a sort of thing where when I start to realize that this is the end part of the music, then I'll sort of know what to finish up or what details to finish off. But I've taken to listening to a lot of looped music, like looped soundtracks and stuff that go on for about 10 minutes.
Okay.
Because those are quite useful timing things, while they can play pretty generically in the background.
Okay. Nice tip. Thank you very much for that. Any apps? What kind of apps do you have on your phone that you use a lot?
And
organize yourself or
think I might need to look at my apps in order to remind me of that. In fact, that's okay. Why not? I don't think I use any particular app to help me with my dyslexia.
Okay.
That's the thing. I will look at my apps.
Well, I'm not talking about just dyslexia, but, you know, or your life in general, you know, dyslexia often, I've seen you use the voice to text.
Right. Yes.
You've done a number of them.
Yes, that's totally right. Actually, in that case, yes, I use my photos on my phone to take photos of certain notes to remind me of them, because I find it difficult to remember.
Yeah.
Like, I've rented a car to get here, and I had to take a photo of the license plate because I couldn't trust myself to remember it off the top of my head.
Okay.
And other things like, yes, instead of texting would take me so long. So now I actually use the voice recording app to actually speak into the voice app. It picks up your voice and predicts the text based on the words you're saying.
Yeah.
And that's much faster and much easier for me. I'm speaking it rather than typing it.
I use the same.
Do you?
Yeah.
You have to be careful, don't you, with some of the typos.
Siri's terrible, but if you click the actual voice to text thing within Apple, it's amazing how accurate it can be.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Totally. And it recognizes even when you say comma and semicolon, so
new paragraph,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's I do highly recommend that. And then just make sure you check your text message after.
Yeah. Any final things you want to kind of say? Let to the listeners, you know, parents and who are listening, maybe even other teachers, you know, out there. What would you say? Final thoughts.
I just say, be patient. Don't get too frustrated with someone when they're being difficult. Yes, kids will sometimes just be difficult, on top of whatever difficulties they might be having, or they might lack motivation. Certainly, I was bad at maths, but it also meant I had no passion for maths at school at the time. So yes, I'm not saying kids don't muck around and kids can be disillusioned and stuff, but do be patient with them. Think of if they're causing a trouble in class or in the family or and homework and stuff, do look to why is that happening, what can be done. If you could look at it yourself when you're teaching a lesson or you're doing the kids' homework with them, if you can think of it as you give 50% to it and they give 50%, your 50% is to make it as engaging as you can and to give them the patience and to basically present that lesson and that information with them in as good a way as you can, and without expecting anything back from them. And then the other 50% is in their court, and the part of them that wants to learn and wants to do better will work with you on that. They will find a way. I think if you just keep trying things and keep doing your end of it, then yes, you can't force them to be motivated, but at least you're doing your part of it. Where it falls down is if you're doing it one way and you feel like entitled to, or that you expect them to learn your way because you're trying to do your part of the lesson. They should be making an effort, sort of thing. When you do it that way, I think that's when the problems begin. You know, that's when the child already knows that they can't do it that way and they're going to struggle. So that was a big splurge. Basically, I'll say that...
Thanks, Rossi.
Yeah, basically, I just want to say be patient with children out there. They're so capable. Just look to see what makes them tick and what they're struggling with. So thank you for having me.
Rossi, it's been great having you. We're at our end. And how do people find out more about you? Where do they find information?
They can find out more about me. You can Google my name, Rossi Stone, R-O-S-S-I-E, Stone. Or you can type in Deco Comics, D-E-K-K-O, Comics.
.com or .co.uk?
Well, that's the thing, there's also the website. Oh. So I do recommend checking out our website to find out more about what we do. It is www.decocomics.com.
Okay, brilliant, brilliant. Rossi, it's been great having this time with you and hearing your story in depth. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Darius. Thank you.
I hope it's helped some of the parents out there understand their children's doodles.
Well, you can but hope, can you?
Great. See you later.
See ya.